need to and want to remind folks that this is a session originated by and sponsored by the Community Health Planning and Policy Development Section. If you'd like to become involved in the section, either as a primary or a secondary membership or volunteer for any of the activities, there is a sign-up sheet in the back. There is also a list here of the sessions, of which there are still a fair number remaining today that the section arranged for. So again, thanks to everybody at the section for making these issues a priority. This report, Promoting Equity Through the Practice of Health Impact Assessment, was supported by the Kresge Foundation and the California Endowment, whom David also mentioned. And in California, that endowment is the preeminent foundation, I think it's fair to say, with taking active interest in how the social determinants of health and the recognition of the importance of addressing upstream factors and prevention translates into research and advocacy at the community level, and has this commitment to process equity as process as well as equity as outcomes. The report has four co-authors and four sponsor organizations. PolicyLink, as I mentioned, and it's my former colleague Shireen Malik-Afzali who was the key author. I had the privilege of working with her, being her supervisor, being an editor of this report, and working on what the HIA is I'm going to refer to, but she was truly the driver of this. She is now at the San Mateo County, California Health Department, getting a chance to be a local practitioner to follow through on these issues. Jonathan Heller, founder and head of Human Impact Partners, who David also just alluded to. Third partner was the Adler School of Professional Psychology in Chicago. They have a particular interest in criminal justice, mental health, racial equity, and inclusion, and have used HIA in those areas in particular. But Lynn Todman of the Adler School was an active partner in all this, and if your interests are in those issues, and or if you're in the Chicago area, I strongly recommend you talking to Lynn and folks at the Adler School about their interest in health impact assessment. The fourth partner was a local practitioner, the San Francisco Department of Public Health, the Environmental Health Section. Megan Weir was the staff member who was the co-author. She works for Rajiv Bhatia, who had been the originator of many of the healthy communities measurement tools that were in the very first HIAs that we know of public health departments having done. And a lot of our experience at PolicyLink and, frankly, of practitioners in public health and city planning around the country comes from what started in San Francisco. So we were very privileged at PolicyLink to work with these other three groups and have a sense of national reach with regard to equity in HIA, and we appreciate all of their efforts. You can find the report on our website and the websites of each of these organizations. I mentioned earlier that we had several definitions of equity that overlap, and as David said, they take into account process as well as outcomes, and they have a very broad understanding of community and health inequities that need to be addressed. And the key message about why ensure equity in HIA is about the centrality of these things, these principles to decision-making, and the opportunity, I like the way David put it, the opportunity to think about it as prevention on a policy scale. Having said that, the report has a structure that uses a few case studies, as David said, but organizes the work with respect to strategies for ensuring HIA. There are eight of these strategies. What I thought I would do is mention them briefly and then go back through them, and in each case, try to learn by example. So we have three HIAs I'm going to talk about. I'm just going to toggle back and forth with a brief example from one of the three or two of the three, as the case may be, for each of these eight strategies. The strategies, to lay them out first in general terms, is the first is not surprisingly targeting health impact assessment practice towards the priorities of disadvantaged populations. This means listening and hearing from the communities who would be affected by the proposed policy and asking them and understanding from them what is important to them. Often this ends up not being an issue that public health practitioners would have put at the top of a narrowly defined health list. It might be housing itself, it might be housing affordability, or displacement. It might be employment-related issues that are indirectly consequences of health inequities. But listening and getting those priorities is important. Secondly, ensuring that the HIA has the goal of evaluating the outcomes that affect those communities. You might take that for granted, but again, being explicit about that. A lot of times this is expressed as disaggregation. A lot of attention to race or age or gender or national origin or any number of other ways of sorting through populations to make sure that the most vulnerable populations, the outcomes for them are understood with respect to the data used for the projects. Related to that, what was called evaluate the distribution of impacts across populations. Again, sometimes particularly development projects in large areas tend to talk about aggregate impacts, X number of jobs or Y number of new housing units. And until you think and act on the income and other implications of the distribution of these aggregate numbers, you don't have what you need. The fourth principle, and I was very moved yesterday by listening to Doran Schrantz, the executive director of ISAIA, the grassroots organizing group in Minnesota, whose group is a veteran of HIAs, including one we're going to talk about, emphasize how this is a tool for empowerment. HIAs can be part of a community organizing strategy, a community leadership building strategy. Leadership, ownership, oversight, and participation. There's a list at the front of the HIA for the light rail project in the central corridor of St. Paul, Minnesota, that lists nearly 100 people who participated in that project in one way or another. And it wasn't just casual participation. It was grinding out long, complicated decisions at meetings that affected them. It was taking responsibility for how the study would be done. We were technical partners, but we were not driving the process, and neither were the staff of ISAIA, to be honest. The resident leadership there and in other cases, like the one we'll talk about in the Central Valley, was key. Four more of these. Again, you can see they're not absolutely distinct. There are some overlaps, but hopefully each one has a little nuance. Identify recommendations that maximize benefits. If you're going to focus the analysis on disaggregating the impacts on different populations, let's make sure we have something to say about outcomes, about recommendations that can lead to better outcomes. The sixth one just emphasizes, and we do this at PolicyLink a lot, we emphasize to ourselves the importance of communication, the importance of framing ideas and issues and findings in ways that are cogent and salient and accessible and that keep the equity issues at the fore. We're often training on this, but other times we're not the leaders on this. It's the grassroots leaders themselves who have the most cogent and relevant formulations of how to communicate this. The next one is not just participation in doing the HIA. This one speaks to helping residents and other community leaders take what they've learned and become active participants in the public processes by which these decisions get made. It might be city government talking about how transit area development takes place. It might be county government or regional government talking about how greenhouse gas strategies will be implemented. But what you see is that the same community leaders who learn from the HIA by being participants are then well equipped to go to the city, go to the county, or go to the Metropolitan Planning Organization and be articulate, empowered participants in those public decision-making processes. The last one is related to that. We should come out of doing this kind of work with stronger community-based organizations, organizations who have learned a lot from the experience and are interested, willing, and able to go back into the fray next time, build their cadre of leadership, and build their capacity to express their priorities and act on them in a way that is constructive. Because they, as much as anybody else, want to get out of the reactive mode that David was referring to and get into the mode of being able to propose alternatives. So that sort of takes you from beginning to end of that process, from the problem definition through the analysis, through the management of the way in which the HIA is used and understood, to the way in which the leaders who participate in it act in the public sphere. And that's sort of the way we think about this work when we look at different cases, because HIA is a very deliberate, if nothing else, it is a very deliberate process with a set of stages that whatever the details may, however the details may vary, always has that kind of flow and fidelity to data and fidelity to community and engagement. These are the three cases I'm going to refer to briefly as we go back through those eight strategies. The first one took place over a period of a couple of years. I put 2011, I think that's when our report was finished, but it started a couple years later and things are still going on. But a new light rail system is being built in the Twin Cities in Minnesota. One of the most important lines will run from roughly downtown Minneapolis or around the University of Minnesota through the University Avenue corridor, Frogtown neighborhoods in the old part of St. Paul, just above the Rondo neighborhood. So it's become known as the Central Corridor. It will end up in downtown St. Paul. And there were a whole set of community strategies to make that light rail line as relevant and helpful and non-troublesome to that diverse low-income community as possible. One of them was the health impact assessment that Isaiah organized. And I should say that all three of these were supported by the Pew Trust's health impact project that David alluded to, that truly has been the leader in generating HIAs that have a focus on equity and have community organizers in their lead. The executive summary of the report of this Healthy Corridor for All, HIA, is here, and I have a copy you can look up afterwards. It is also on the PolicyLink website and the website of the other partners, Isaiah, a grassroots organizing network, faith-based grassroots organizing network, and the Hmong organizing project of Take Action Minnesota. The neighborhood is extremely diverse in many ways, but one of the largest Hmong populations in the country. And their ways of organizing were central to the project. It's near the Rondo neighborhood, which is one of the oldest African-American neighborhoods in Minnesota, and which had been devastated by freeway construction 30 years earlier. So people were highly skeptical that a light rail project, even one underground, would end up being a net benefit rather than another disruptor. The second example is from a very different environment. It's from the rural small towns of Fresno County, California. There's also one underway in Kern County, which is where Bakersfield is, but so far the analytical work is furthest in Fresno. Here, the example depends on reacting to the mandate the state of California gave through Senate Bill 375 to every regional government in California to develop greenhouse gas reduction strategies. And for that, you need a transportation land use strategy to reduce vehicle miles traveled. Now, in the Central Valley, with its terrible air quality issues, there are many other factors that cause the high greenhouse gas and high particulate matter and ozone. But it's an area characterized by tremendous amounts of driving and metropolitan sprawl, and also hundreds of small towns, unincorporated, disadvantaged communities. And this HIA was designed to make sure that the impacts of the proposed changes in development patterns that the greenhouse gas reduction mandate required would not be detrimental to these low-income rural communities, many of which are predominantly settled by farm workers, Latino farm workers, and many of which have had a hard time breaking into the policy process. So the common theme, of course, of using the HIA to empower marginalized communities, but very different context. We're going to be talking about the work of a researcher named Alex Karner, who presented on a panel with Julie and I 2 days ago. He is at the University of California, Davis, and they're partners with several community groups in the Valley, California Rural Legal Assistance, and a new group called Leadership Council for Justice and Accountability, who's been working on these rural equity issues for quite some time. The third one has to do with bus service and funding and the health impacts of changes and particularly cutbacks in bus service in Oakland and Berkeley and Emeryville and the other cities of Alameda County, California, where I live. I was not involved in this HIA, nor was PolicyLink, so I can't speak with the same level of detail about it, but I came across it recently, was fascinated by the way they framed the issue. The Alameda County Public Health Department took the lead here, along with a group called the Data Center, which is a longstanding community research organization in Oakland, and a very, very active group of bus riders and public officials committed to health impacts of local transit service. So we'll kick back and forth among those three as we go ahead. I'll mention before that that our very first foray into the work that David was describing about regional planning, transportation, upstream factors, was to look at transportation policy in general. This is a report from about 5 years ago that Prevention Institute and PolicyLink put out under the auspices of the Convergence Partnership, the collection of foundations that make these issues a priority. And if you want to sort of trace this work back to some of its origins, that's not a bad place to start. And when I look back on it, I see that a lot of the HIAs that deal with land use and transportation around the country are still building on the examples that we learned about when this was first getting started. This is the Healthy Corridor for All, the Minnesota Light Rail project. Again, it'll be available on the it is available on the PolicyLink website. This is the cover from the Alameda County Bus Service one, Getting on Board for Health, an HIA of bus funding and access. I have one copy of that executive summary here. And I checked the full report, which is almost 70 pages, is available on the Alameda County Public Health Department's website. And this is a cover sheet from the presentation that Alex Carner did the other day at this same conference about the Central Valley, specifically Fresno County and its response to SB 375. How does the greenhouse gas reduction strategy affect these rural communities? That's where Fresno County is. We'll give you a couple more slides from Alex's work just to give you one more at any rate to get a feel for that. This is the area with some of the worst air quality in the nation. So as you can imagine, addressing greenhouse gases through reducing driving has tremendous benefits for other forms of air pollution as well as greenhouse gases. But it raises the questions of what are we saying about these rural communities? Are we saying they're too far from the city and therefore we should discourage development? And will that make the residents there worse off with the intention of improving air quality? Does it mean that they should get high-income development, and what would that mean for the low-income residents who were there? Growth scenarios are very complicated things, and transportation challenges that they raise. This is one of the most ambitious efforts to try to understand the health implications of a countywide transportation challenge. So there, back to the eight strategies really quickly. We've mentioned this a little bit. The first one, target the practice towards those disadvantaged groups, give them leadership, ownership, oversight, and participation. In Minnesota and Healthy Corridor for All, a huge array of organizations beyond the three who were the sponsors. And the other day, Doran Schrantz of Isaiah said something that stuck with me. Let me see if I can reproduce it. But you're bringing a different set of values into the policy process by making sure that the community leadership is part of this. There's nothing less than that. It's not just about an individual policy decision. It's about the way in which the decisions are made. Who owns the overall process? How do you put affected communities at the center of the process? And that was their goal at the most fundamental level. In the San Joaquin Valley, CRLA, California Rural Legal Assistance, and a spinoff group called Leadership Council for Justice and Accountability had been working on issues of sewers, water supply, safe streets, street lights, community parks, and all kinds of things related to social determinants of health for years. But they'd mainly been doing it through legal strategies, through suing county governments and special districts and sometimes the state of California when they could make a case on civil rights or protection grounds that service was inadequate. And they wanted to continue the process they've been doing with PolicyLink of building a more broad-based analytical style of coming up with alternative policies. So they have hundreds of residents from all of these little communities, some of which only have a couple hundred residents, all over Fresno County. They also have very powerful university partners, Fresno State University's Health Policy Institute for the Central Valley, and the group where Alex works, the Center for Regional Change at UC Davis. So there's kind of an intersection of advocates, legal advocates, resident leaders, and health researchers and urban planning researchers. In Alameda County, as I said, the health department was the driver of the bus funding, but there were 18 diverse groups on an advisory committee. And if you know Oakland, you know that those groups have been on the case of AC Transit and the state for many years, so that they were experienced advocates already. That second strategy, ensure the goal is to evaluate outcomes. In Minnesota, the group defined the important health the issues that were most important to them. They were given a health and upstream factors framework, if you will. But to be honest, the issues that moved them the most were housing, employment opportunities, and bus transportation. In other words, what would happen to the bus system when the new light rail came in? What would happen to the industrial jobs that were in the corridor if the transit led to a different kind of development that displaced industrial jobs where a lot of their residents with low levels of education had been working? What would happen to housing costs? Would their communities be threatened by higher income development if there weren't sufficient affordable housing steps taken? So in practice, most of that HIA was about these issues of urban planning and development, and the health impact consequences were more of the secondary or downstream ones. And we've already mentioned what the values were of the of that particular strategy: equity, community empowerment, collaboration, accountability to each other and to the fidelity of the research process. In the Fresno area, the SB 375 health impact assessment, the focus there again was on infrastructure issues. People can see the health consequences pretty directly of not having safe water to drink, not having sewers or sidewalks, not having adequate streetlights or parks. So they use this new regional planning as a way of making sure that the nuts and bolts issues of having a livable community did not get overlooked in the big think about scenarios. This is a little from Alex's presentation about the Central Valley. The promise of a good growth scenario that would reduce sprawl is tremendous, but the peril is that these small rural communities will either be left alone with no improvements, or they could actually be displaced if some of their land was attractive for higher income development, and both things are actually possible. He went through a series of analyses of the scenarios that the Council of Governments for Fresno County came up with. And all of this is on the Center for Regional Change's website in preliminary form, will be up completed within 2 months. But basically, the last one on the right, Scenario D, is one that the community groups had been proposing even before the HIA started. And the HIA serves to analyze some health impacts, some distal health impacts of different rates of growth, different types of growth in Fresno County, and generally shows that the ones that reflect well on reducing sprawl can also be better for these rural communities. We won't be going into the technicalities of that presentation today, but we can give you access to that if it's of interest to you. But the basic idea is comparing scenarios. Where does transportation go? How much housing? How much density to the housing? Where are we making our commitments of where we're going to grow? The key equity issues had to do with where the growth goes and how those disadvantaged communities are created. And how do you create walkable communities in the countryside? A lot of that HIA in the Valley focuses, therefore, on active travel, physical activity, and he has some good measures of what the direct consequences would be of various growth scenarios. Our next strategy, moving quickly here, evaluate distribution of impacts. The bus funding HIA was based mainly on a survey of riders, a report of what their priorities were, what they used the bus for, what they'd lose if service was cut back, and projections of those things. In the Healthy Corridor, as I mentioned, housing, employment, and transportation rose to the top, not only as a priority, and that fit into a great deal of other planning that was going on about the corridor, and also how would small businesses survive the construction process of an underground rail line and then be viable once it was created. And I've just mentioned what some of the other SB 375 methods were, what Alex calls comparative risk assessment. This is that central corridor in Minnesota, the line runs roughly through the center of that cluster of neighborhoods. The darker the shade of red, the higher the proportion of vehicle of households without vehicles, and you can see that darkest shade is from 41% to 67%. So this is the neighborhood that was already heavily trans-dependent and will be even more so. And they were actually worried that putting in a light rail system, while it gives them access to the region, could actually hurt the bus system. Some places cut down on the bus system when they have the trains. So that became a very important issue. And there were detailed analyses of small business and businesses owned by the various minority groups in the community and what would happen to them in the short and long run. And this is back to Fresno. This is how the scenarios are evaluated. Again, our goal isn't to go through these in detail, but for you to just get a sense that it's a measurement of what conditions exist now, what will happen with the new scenarios with regard to the risks for various chronic conditions, as well as the capacity to walk or use various other kinds of non-vehicular transportation. Moving quickly through the rest of these strategies and onto recommendations, in Minnesota, the proposals led to an affordable housing task force, and Doran reported yesterday that more than $1 million has been won for an affordable housing trust fund, and a policy for inclusionary housing and new development has been approved, and that there's an ongoing table at which the residents sit with the decision makers in the public sector and the developers about future development. I would say housing is the largest area of success for the impact of this HIA. In Fresno, it's far too soon to tell. These scenarios haven't even been officially released, let finalized yet. Alex is doing this preliminary analysis with the data and scenario drafts that are available. But hopefully the recommendations will fit in the period between January and March into the final reports that the county has to make and adopt in order to comply with the state rules. Communications we talked about. It's important to say that this isn't only about numbers. Photographs are important, other kinds of imagery, translation of material from meetings to different documents, of different documents and translation of meetings to all the different languages of the participants in the programs are critically important. You see that in each case. And then finally, participation. As we mentioned, the folks in Fresno and Kern were already somewhat experienced, but now they are extremely empowered to be players in the deliberations of the Council of Governments and the other players in the greenhouse gas reduction strategies, not just the lawyers, but the residents themselves. The bus riders back in Oakland and Alameda County were organized to some degree before and will be even more so. And then finally, building capacity, the beginning and the end of this process in many ways. In Alameda County, the group was very committed to a CBPR approach, and the residents have more understanding of how to do survey research and how it can affect the policy process. And back in Kern, as I said, they are now very experienced resident advocates, tying their work on greenhouse gases to their other work to get clean water, sewers, and other activities. So that is a quick tour through how three of the most important recent HIAs that we've been exposed to have been playing out. And recommend, as I said, for the two that are finished to look at the reports, and for the one in Fresno to keep an eye on the work of Dr. Alex Carner, or to contact me if you'd like more information about them. So with you see that framework of strategies, you see the various types of things that are possible. We're going to turn now to one case study which we can go through in more depth. Julie West of the Seattle King County Public Health Department has been the project lead for one of these, and she's going to give you a little context for it and then go through it in a little more detail. So thanks very much for your attention to this part.